This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley. In a moment, why hopes are high that a ceasefire deal in Gaza might finally be about to be agreed. Also on the programme, a rescue operation is underway at a South African mine to bring hundreds of workers up to the surface. And we speak to the families of Ukrainian prisoners of war who are facing attempts by Russia to get them to carry out sabotage.
He said they'd kill my husband. For days he kept calling, saying, "Your husband is being tortured and it's your fault."
Did you at any point consider going through with it?
No. Not for a second. My husband never would have forgiven me if I had done something like that.
That report in about 45 minutes from now. First, after 15 months of a bloody war that's had big repercussions around the world, what is happening in Qatar today has been described as the final round of peace talks. Qatar's foreign ministry says the major differences have been overcome between Israel and Hamas, and a draft agreement exists for a ceasefire in Gaza. Here's Majid Al-Ansari, the Qatari foreign ministry spokesman.
So the main reason why we are more optimistic right now is, as I said, you know, during the past month there were underlying issues, major issues between the two parties unresolved. These issues were resolved during the talks in the past couple of weeks, and therefore we have reached a point where the major issues that were preventing a deal from happening were addressed, and we have language pertaining to these issues that has been distributed between both parties. We especially appreciate the roles of both the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration in the talks in the past couple of weeks.
President Biden says the deal is imminent and will free hostages, halt the fighting, and provide security to Israel, as well as allowing more humanitarian aid to reach the Palestinians. The Israeli far-right politician Itamar Ben-Gvir is the leader of an ultranationalist party in the coalition government and national security minister. He said the proposed deal was not acceptable.
The deal that is being developed is a surrender deal to Hamas. I call on my friend, Minister Bezalel Smotrich, to join me and cooperate with me against the deal that is being proposed. Our party, Jewish Power, does not have the power on its own to prevent the deal. But together we can go to the Prime Minister and inform him that if he passes this, we will resign from the government.
Jonathan Dekelchen's son, Sagi, an Israeli-American, was abducted by Hamas on October the 7th. My colleague, Julian Marshall, asked him if he was hopeful that there might now finally be a deal.
You know, at the end of the day, this depends essentially on the will of two people. One of them is probably Mohammed Sinwar in Gaza, and the other is Benjamin Netanyahu. And I can't even begin to think what goes through the mind of you know, a terrorist sitting in tunnels under Gaza. I want to believe that, you know, with the added pressure brought to bear by President-elect Trump, that Prime Minister Netanyahu has come to the conclusion that it is in the best interests in Israel and of himself to make sure that, at least from Israel's side, we have gotten to yes. And that's very important in terms of the fate of this agreement.
So do you share the anger, therefore, of the members of other hostage families at Bezalel Smotrich, who is opposing a proposed deal?
Well, you know, I don't know the finance minister personally. It's for me, it's not so much about personal anger against him or anyone else. It's more about our vision of what Israel is supposed to be. And among other things, it is a country that's dedicated to the preservation of Jewish life. And, you know, given the catastrophe of October 7th, for which he, as a member of the cabinet at that time, it does bear responsibility, it is just incomprehensible to the vast majority of Israelis that still, 15 months into this war, people like the finance minister still believe that there is an advantage to continuing this fighting and further risking the lives of our hostages and putting in peril, of course, the lives of Palestinian civilians.
That was Jonathan Dekel Chen, whose son Sagi was abducted by Hamas on October the 7th. He was speaking to Julian Marshall. What do we know then about what is in this draft deal and how close is an actual ceasefire this time? Let's speak to the BBC State Department correspondent Tom Bateman, who joins us now live from Washington. Previously, he was our correspondent in Jerusalem. Welcome, Tom. Is there anything significantly different in this from what has been proposed before?
On the face of it, there's not. We are still really, in terms of the big picture of this agreement, where we were right back in May, nearly 8 months ago, when President Biden announced the framework for a deal, which has seen over the months many moments of near breakthrough, only for them to falter and fall apart towards the end, with both sides blaming the other for intransigence or for upping their demands. What we know about this one, and we don't know everything, but we know from a Palestinian official close to the negotiations who has described a 6 weeks first phase ceasefire deal in which 34 hostages would be released by Hamas in exchange for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. And this, the hostage releases would take place in stages during that 6 weeks, starting with an initial three hostages. Meanwhile, you would get Israeli forces withdrawing from populated areas in the Gaza Strip. And then crucially, during that 6 week process, if it continues to go to plan, the two sides would negotiate phase two, which is supposed to be, according to the Biden framework, you know, a complete end to the war, a permanent ceasefire and a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and all the rest of the hostages, including Israeli soldiers, being released.
Can the Israeli prime minister afford members of his government to walk out? Is that what's changed?
I don't think that is what has changed, because that threat has always lingered over this. And that's been one of the reasons why in Israel, Mr. Netanyahu's opponents have accused him of being more interested in staying in power than in doing a deal to get the hostages out and to get a ceasefire. That hasn't changed. I think, frankly, what has changed is US politics, because although the Biden administration has tried to exert pressure onto Mr. Netanyahu, it hasn't really been until there's been a meaningful deadline, which becomes something crucial in a negotiation. If you think that the terms that are on offer now might disappear at a certain point in time, that does add pressure and momentum. And I think that's what's happened here, because Donald Trump, I mean, it's very clear that for Hamas, the conditions would get significantly worse under Donald Trump. He said that they would have hell to pay if they don't start releasing the hostages. And certainly he is far less committed to a sort of, you know, future of Palestinian self-governance in Gaza than the Biden administration would be. So the terms change, but they also change for Mr. Netanyahu, because he doesn't have the same certainty that, you know, if once you have a Trump administration, you lose the Biden conditions, crucially, with the guarantee that the Biden administration has given that it would act as a guarantor to get from phase one to phase two, so that it would back that, put pressure on Qatar, to put pressure on Hamas to get them to a, you know, to get them to get all the hostages out, basically. So I think it gets more difficult for both sides, basically because they lose certainty. They don't know that Donald Trump is as committed to this as the Biden administration has been. And I think that's created this pressure of a meaningful deadline, and why the two sides are now racing towards the finish on this.
Many thanks. That's the State Department correspondent for the BBC, Tom Bateman, speaking to us live from Washington, D.C. So lives will be saved every day the war in Gaza is shortened, of course. Palestinians are reported to be following every aspect of news from these negotiations in Qatar. I've been speaking to Khada Al-Kurd, who's a writer and journalist based at the moment in central Gaza.
Well, we've been waiting this moment for 15 months now. Maybe this is the last hour of this war against Gaza Strip to end our sufferings, to end our displacement as a Palestinian civilian. I'm originally from North Gaza, from Jabalia.
Are you actually optimistic this time?
Well, it seems like all the current situation is very optimistic. I'm not the only one who is optimistic. This should be end, like after 15 months of conflict, of fighting between Israel and Hamas and sufferings, and this fighting should be at the end. I'm optimistic this time.
If a ceasefire is agreed, what are your plans then, Khada?
I will wait for 1 week after the agreement is done, so we will be able to return to North Gaza. This is the first thing I will do. I will go there. I will see my daughters. It's been like 15 months. I didn't see them. I didn't hug them. So I want to go there. The first thing I want to do, just to hug my daughters, to smell them, to touch them, to kiss them, and spend like maybe months, two, three, I don't know, only with my daughters, because like it's heartbreaking to be away from them. I know they suffered a lot, and I suffered a lot being away from them. So the first thing I want to do to see my daughters.
What is life like where you are right now?
In south or in central areas of the Gaza Strip, in Deir al-Balah, I think we have like a good, at least have internet, we have some kind of water, we have food. But I don't know if I come back to Gaza, this services will be available there. We hope like with the entering of humanitarian aid trucks to North Gaza, the life will be better.
What are you expecting of a ceasefire? No Israeli presence in Gaza at all?
The agreement should be implemented in stages, but at least as they agreed, and I think they will release all the hostages. If one remain in Gaza Strip, it means the war will continue. I think as a Palestinian, and most of the Palestinians maybe agree with me, we don't want any Israeli hostages in Gaza Strip. Because like bringing them to Gaza brought a lot of sufferings to the Palestinian people. So I think the only solution to return them back to Israel, and we can, both of us, the Israelis and the Palestinians, live normally.
And what about Israeli military presence in Gaza?
Well, it seems that they will stay for 1 kilometer from the buffer zone and maybe on the corridor, just to make sure that the militant of Hamas or Islamic Jihad, they have no presence. I think they will agree after that about these stages and how they will implement it. It's under the table, but for us as Palestinian or journalists or decision makers, still we don't have like a clear idea about this agreement, but we will see in the upcoming few weeks.
That was Khada Al-Ghoud speaking to us. Apologies for the quality of the line, from central Gaza. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're live from London. We are NewsHour. Much more to come. Coming up, the painstaking operation to rescue hundreds of miners trapped 2 kilometres underground in South Africa.
They're lowering down the specialised crane into this abandoned shaft. I think 6 to 8 people can fit in at a time. So basically they're winching it down and up this 2 kilometre dark hole. Nobody seems to know specifically how many people are down there, but it's going to take quite a while to get them all up. And that includes scores of dead bodies.
Other headlines, what's reported to be the final round of talks on a deal to release hostages and secure a ceasefire in Gaza are now underway in Qatar. And the Japanese city of Kyoto has announced a tenfold increase in hotel taxes to reduce the overwhelming numbers of tourists visiting its ancient sites. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC. Now, the BBC's been told of safety failings on board an Egyptian dive boat that sank last November, killing nearly a dozen people. Egyptian authorities had previously blamed the disaster on what they called a massive wave. Our correspondent Joe Inwood has been speaking to nearly a dozen survivors, including one woman who spent 35 hours trapped in an air pocket.
This is what it sounds like, trapped inside the hull of a slowly sinking ship. The footage you can hear was filmed by Luciana Galetta and her partner Christoph, 4 hours in to a 35-hour ordeal. Our things are coming back to us, Christoph says, as their possessions float by. The experience still haunts Luciana.
I was ready to die. And for me, to be honest, it's very weird to be alive compared to the others.
She was one of the very last people to be rescued from the Sea Story, a luxury dive boat that sank in Egypt's Red Sea. To see it before the disaster, it looks luxurious. 4 stories high with polished decks, there's even a jacuzzi. But on the morning of the 25th of November, it went down in just minutes. We've interviewed nearly a dozen survivors who, for the first time, have spoken of the terror of that night. Isora Gonzalez describes the moment the ship went down.
All of a sudden, it went BAM! My bed was in the wall, and my friend Christian was on top of me. I was really disorientated, so I couldn't find the lights. My friend starts shouting at me, saying, run, run, get out, get out!
Justin Hodges was just down the hall from Isora and helped lift other passengers to safety once he'd escaped his own cabin.
I didn't realize that the whole boat at that point was already on its side, and there was water gushing in the room.
Isora managed to make it into the water, but she didn't have a life jacket.
Everything was pitch black. The sky was black. The sea was black. We remember looking at the boat, and the boat kept sinking, and we just screamed, swim away from the boat!
Isora, Justin, and 18 others managed to escape the boat before it was fully submerged. Luciana was one of 16 who did not.
We didn't hear any boat, we didn't hear anyone, we didn't hear anything, not even another helicopter. So I was just wondering how I would prefer to die. To drown, because I would try to get out of this boat. Or if I needed to wait to be thirsty and hungry, I was ready to die.
She would spend 35 hours sitting on fuel tanks before local divers braved the wreck.
Oh my God, it's so dangerous.
Speaking shortly after, the Egyptian authorities were quick to blame a wave.
Oh my God.
But what you can hear now is footage from just hours before the sinking of the Sea Story. It was taken after one of the small boats slipped off the back and clearly shows relatively small waves. This footage, plus the testimony of the 11 survivors we spoke to, cast doubt on the official narrative. One of the voices you can hear is Sarah Martin, a doctor from Lancashire. She ended up in the water alongside Justin and Isora.
When we were in the water, the waves weren't so big that, you know, we weren't able to swim in them or anything like that. So it's not like it was extremely stormy or anything that seemed highly unusual with the conditions. So it does leave us wondering, you know, why that boat sank.
Dr. Simon Boxall is an oceanographer at the University of Southampton.
I've had a look at the available data for that region for wind conditions, and there is no way that a large wave would have caused the vessel to capsize. That really then boils down to two options, either a navigator error or an error in the design of the vessel. The chances are it could be a combination of both.
In total, 11 people are thought to have died. Neither the Egyptian government nor the company who owned the boat responded to our detailed questions. But it's understood there has been a tightening of the rules governing dive boats in the last few weeks. If lessons have been learned, they have come at a very heavy price.
That was the BBC's Joe Inwood reporting. A new study in England and Wales suggests that among women seeking abortions, there has been a significant increase in the proportion using fertility awareness methods, such as period tracking apps. Women in England and Wales are increasingly ditching the pill and thereby raising the risk of unplanned pregnancies. The research is published in the British Medical Journal. What are these fertility apps and why are they increasingly popular? I've been speaking to Dr. Patricia Law, Director of Research and Innovation at the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. She is co-author of this report.
There are a range of what are called fertility awareness-based methods, but there's only one app that's actually been approved to be used as a contraceptive method, and that's called Natural Cycles. But fertility awareness-based methods have been used for years and years. The most simple one is just tracking your cycles using a calendar, but you can also do things like measuring your body temperature every day and looking for changes at the time of ovulation.
Because generally, there's only a 48-hour window in which to get pregnant, isn't there? But things can vary.
And you're quite right. You either need to have had sex before or soon after ovulation in order to be able to get pregnant. Sperm can live in the human body for up to 5 days. So it is possible to have vaginal intercourse before you ovulate and become pregnant from that encounter.
Why are women apparently ditching more conventional methods of contraception like the pill in favor of this clearly less reliable method?
So we can't actually tell from the study that we did that women are ditching hormonal contraception, but we know from other studies that some people are just worried about taking hormones and some people want to be in control. And of course, with this fertility awareness-based method, you're completely in control. But I think there's definitely a call there for more research to be done.
So you don't know if speculation is founded that women in the UK are finding it harder to access contraception?
We know that contraceptive services availability decreased during the pandemic, and some still haven't gotten up and going to the same level that they were. We also know that there's a problem with funding contraception in this country, and in some areas it has gotten worse and not better.
The trend away from hormonal contraception does correspond with a rise in abortion rates in England and Wales, worrying for a health service already overloaded, worrying for women going through abortions?
I mean, firstly, yes. In this particular study, we saw that there were more abortions performed in the second period than in the first period. And this was at the same time that we were recording changes in people's choices or use of contraceptive methods. But we don't know what the linkage is between them. For example, we have made abortion easier to access with the introduction of telemedicine. So we can't draw a one-to-one correlation in this study. But I do think the most important thing here is that abortion needs to be available. It's very safe. It's very effective.
Even with the approved app, there's a significant failure rate, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. What's been reported with the app in its typical use is a failure rate of about 7%. So about 7 in 100 women getting pregnant in the first year of use. All contraceptive methods have a failure rate. So some of them have a higher failure rate than what's been reported with the app.
Do you sound a note of caution about fertility apps?
I don't necessarily sound a note of caution, but I do think that people need good counseling about using a contraceptive app or a fertility awareness-based method in terms of how to use it correctly and what the likelihood of failure is with that method so that they're prepared.
That was Dr. Patricia Law from the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Spain is planning to impose a tax of up to 100% on properties bought by foreigners from outside the EU. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said the measure, which could especially affect British people, was needed to help tackle the country's housing crisis. Guy Hedgeco is our correspondent in Madrid. I asked him what exactly the government was proposing.
Well, what we know so far is what the Prime Minister has said, which is that the idea would be that non-residents from outside the European Union who purchase properties in Spain would have to pay a tax of up to 100% on the value of that property. So obviously that's potentially a very large amount of money. Mr. Sanchez himself said that in 2023 there are around 27,000 such purchases made by non-EU non-residents. So he seems to think that this is quite a substantial part of the housing market. The government website has given a little bit more detail, saying that this is a policy which is in place in some other countries. It talks about Denmark and Canada having similar policies in place. So it clearly doesn't think it's totally outlandish to introduce this policy.
And that's by no means a foregone conclusion, is it?
No, it's not. Now, the opposition Conservatives say that the government is being far too interventionist in the housing market. But on the other hand, there are also parliamentary allies of Mr. Sanchez further to his left. He's a socialist and he has allies to his left. And some of those allies say he doesn't go far enough with his interventionism in the market. So I think it's going to be quite difficult for him to get this through Congress. It's not necessarily impossible, but it's going to be a pretty tough challenge for him.
I suppose just the government talking about a measure like this could dampen interest among foreign buyers.
I think that's what a lot of people are wondering about, because foreign buyers make up a large part of the housing market. And specifically, this will affect foreign buyers from outside the European Union. Now, the biggest single foreign community who buy property in Spain are the British. Moroccans, for example, also buy a lot of property in Spain. So there are concerns in that sense that, you know, this could have a significant impact on the housing market in Spain. Now, the government feels that impact would be positive in the long term, but there are others who are wondering about that and feel it may just be too drastic.
Developed economies all over the world might be looking at Spain and getting ideas, given the global housing crisis.
Yes, I mean, Spain is by no means the only country in Europe or in the world seeing this kind of crisis, whereby many people, especially young people, are being priced out of the housing market, in particular when it comes to rental. So I think there'll be a lot of other countries, not just around Europe, but around the world, who'll be looking at Spain and how it progresses with these measures and to see whether or not they work.
That was the BBC's Guy Hedgeco reporting from the Spanish capital, Madrid. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, a newly published report says that Donald Trump took part in what it calls an unprecedented criminal effort to overturn his defeat in the 2020 US presidential election. The report by the special counsel Jack Smith says Trump would have been convicted if he hadn't won re-election. The president-elect responded by calling Mr. Smith deranged. I'm joined now by Ankush Kadori, who is a senior writer at Politico magazine. He's been covering the legal prosecutions of Donald Trump, and Ankush is also a former federal prosecutor himself. Welcome to the programme. The report is 150 pages long, but is the conclusion as stark as that? He would have been convicted.
I do think that's sort of the bottom line conclusion for American audiences, because the report itself, so far as I can tell, does not tell us much that we didn't already know. I will say that that conclusion, that the Justice Department believed that Trump was guilty and would be convicted, it was not surprising at all, because Justice Department guidelines require prosecutors, before they charge a case, to determine that they will likely be able to obtain a conviction. So I understand that that's sort of the headline point here in the U.S., but it's been true literally since the filing of the case that the government held that view.
Beyond that, how damning is it of President-elect Trump?
You know, I think it's as damning as audiences make of the revelations over the last couple of years. Because, as I said, you know, the broad contours of this has been out in the American media. It's been out through our January 6th committee, select committee that held hearings over 2022. And, you know, I found that information all quite problematic and quite damning of the president. But of course, Americans have reelected him despite that.
What new insights, if any, does this report offer, perhaps into Jack Smith's investigative process, into the challenges that his team encountered?
Yeah, you know, there's a section in the report on challenges that they encountered. I was actually quite drawn to this because the Justice Department's officials and kind of defenders have said, well, we couldn't have moved more quickly on this case because of all, you know, these investigative impediments that got in the way. You'll see when the report comes out. I've now read that portion of the report, and I am wholly unconvinced of that defense. The impediments that they cite were entirely predictable impediments. Some of them are actually quite conventional for an investigation of this sort. It's not to say that they should have had to encounter them, but I don't. They don't strike me as anything particularly out of the ordinary, anything we didn't know already.
And you've hinted at this already, but really this report is little more than an intellectual exercise, is it not? Given that, A, President Trump's supporters don't care, and B, he won't be convicted of trying to obstruct the 2020 results.
That is exactly right. I would say intellectual exercise, maybe a document for history. But yeah, I think this is going to come and go. The fact that it came out in the middle of the night is sort of oddly fitting. We're less than 2 weeks out from Trump returning to office. And so, yeah, I mean, I think this case is extremely dead. And, I don't think we're going to be hearing much of it after this.
The moment he leaves office, could he be prosecuted then?
There's an open question about that. I think there are a bunch of reasons to doubt that, not least of which is that, first of all, he could pardon himself or have his vice president pardon himself on his way out the door if he thinks he's in danger. And also, the scenario you're contemplating would require whoever takes office in 2029, which could be a Republican again, to actually want to prosecute Donald Trump. So these are all very uncertain contingencies. Nobody should count on that happening.
And in response to the report, the president-elect has come out fighting, hasn't he? I mentioned that he's been insulting Mr. Smith.
Yeah, although he has been doing that the whole time. President-elect Trump, he's been insulting the prosecutors, denigrating them, lying about them, smearing them. Not just Jack Smith and his prosecutors, but the local prosecutors that have been pursuing him as well. So I'm not surprised Donald Trump decided to take another whack at them.
Although perhaps his reaction today briefly indicates that he is bothered.
He's found this whole process quite bothersome. So, yeah, I mean, he's been highly frustrated by it. And I think it is a substantial reason, this investigation and the fact that it was sort of intensifying and sort of necessary is why he ran for re-election in the first place, in my view.
Ankush Kadori, many thanks. Donald Trump's cabinet nominees go under the microscope in Washington from today as U.S. senators hold confirmation hearings that could make or break them. Perhaps the most controversial of 13 choices is the first to be interviewed. Pete Hegseth, the former Army National Guard officer and ex-Fox News host, who is the nominee for U.S. Defense Secretary. I've been speaking to Missy Ryan, reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers national security, and she's been telling me more about why Pete Hegseth is controversial.
He's controversial because he lacks the same kind of national security and management experience that most secretaries of defense have had in recent decades, and also because he has a track record of some pretty problematic allegations, including financial mismanagement, sexual assault, and heavy drinking.
What can we expect from the committee today in terms of the grilling he might get, in particular from Democrats on the committee?
Yeah, so he's going to get really tough questions from the Democrats on the Senate Armed Services Committee, none of whom have voiced support for Hegseth. And we're probably also going to get some sort of probing questions from Republicans. Senate Majority Leader John Thune has said that he thinks Hegseth has the votes. But there are a number of Republicans who have sort of studiously avoided answering directly whether or not they intend to vote for Hegseth, and they've expressed concerns about his record. So I think we're going to see some efforts to try to really clarify what his plans are for the department and whether or not his lack of experience and the sort of problematic aspects of his record will be disqualifying.
The FBI has been investigating him ahead of this hearing, hasn't it?
It has, and the FBI in recent days briefed the chairman and ranking member of the committee. But we did report last night that the FBI did not, for example, interview the woman who is at the heart of this sexual assault allegation against Hegseth in 2017. He has denied all wrongdoing in the case, but he did pay an undisclosed amount to this woman as part of a settlement. So that sort of does raise questions about how thorough the vetting was. Remember, President-elect Trump nominated Hegseth just a few days after he won in the November election. And so there's and normally, you know, there would be a thorough vetting that happens prior to a nominee being tabbed. So this has kind of been a scramble. And so I think a lot of the Democrats are going to say, look, we don't have enough information. We haven't had time to review his financial disclosures, his ethics disclosures, the results of the FBI background check thoroughly enough to conclusively support this nominee. And I think the key question will be what the Republicans who are kind of on the fence are going to do. This is a really big test, the first big test of whether Republicans in Congress are going to defy President Trump on some of his controversial nominees. So I think that that's one of the reasons why everyone is so interested in this position. In addition, of course, to the fact that the Secretary of Defense is such a key job. You're overseeing 3 million civilian and military personnel. You have control over the nuclear stockpile and a budget of more than $800 billion.
What doesn't seem to be in doubt are his credentials as an active soldier. He was admired, it seems, when he served by his colleagues.
Yeah, he was a member of the National Guard, and he served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And certainly the people who are supporting Hegseth point to that. That's been a big part of his identity as a Fox News personality. And so, you know, that certainly is something that is a strong part of the assets that he has going into this nomination hearing. But at the same time, you know, he didn't spend decades in uniform like the current Secretary of Defense. And I think that even those who, you know, on the Democratic side of the aisle who would say, sure, we appreciate his service, but that doesn't compensate for the fact that he has these other problematic elements in his record.
Missy Ryan in Washington. In South Africa, a rescue operation is continuing in Stilfontein to get hundreds of gold miners out of an abandoned shaft. Many are known to have died. The police have been running a campaign to clamp down on the illegal business and had threatened to arrest the men if they surfaced. The miners are part of a significant illicit economy. South African journalist Kimon de Kreef has been documenting the situation. He's writing a book about the illegal miners, and he gave me the latest on the rescue effort first.
There's been this kind of prolonged standoff over the past weeks and months. And as of this week, a formal rescue operation started. This followed a court order. And so they're lowering down the specialized crane into this abandoned shaft. I think 6 to 8 people can fit in at a time. So basically they're winching it down and up this 2 kilometer dark hole. Nobody seems to know specifically how many people are down there, but it's going to take quite a while to get them all up. That includes scores of dead bodies.
And were the men refusing to come up because they were scared of the authorities, or were they trapped?
The police and the state say that people were evading capture and staying down there, and in some cases being kept down there against their will by kind of Zama Zama gang bosses. What people in the community are saying, and sort of human rights activists in South Africa, are saying that the guys were trapped down there with no way of getting up.
You've used the local term for these illegal miners. Who are they, and how many of them are there? How big a deal is this?
Most of them are from neighboring African countries, many of them undocumented. Some of the Zama Zamas who come up say that they had no intention of going down there in the first place, and that they were either deceived or forced, the victims of human trafficking. Others are people who go down because they see that there's no other way that the society that we have is going to give them the kinds of money that they could potentially make from mining gold. Nationally, it's many, many, many thousands of Zama Zamas working in abandoned mines, which were left behind when the industry contracted quite sharply over the past 2 decades.
And the images of the survivors and the bodies coming up are not necessarily ones that the authorities want people to see. Hence, it's difficult to cover this story, isn't it?
Incredibly. So I was up in Stilfontein in November, and already then access to the shaft was very tightly controlled. And it's understandable why. There was a video that was filmed underground showing guys so skeletal, it kind of looked like those survivors of Auschwitz. These are men who have been without steady access to food since late September, I believe. Truly horrendous. And it does make it kind of difficult to report on because access is really controlled. So then there's a kind of police narrative and there's an activist narrative, and trying to establish what's happening in between those has been quite tricky.
The authorities see this, do they, as a sort of stain on the country and the wider publicity about it?
It's a large and very criminalized economy. 10% or more of South Africa's annual gold production is obtained from illegal miners. In many cases, residents in these kind of blighted former mining towns have this ambivalent relationship with the Zama economy. On the one hand, it's bringing money into town, but on the other hand, they're associated with this enormously violent way of life. And so the government does get frequent complaints. That said, the root causes of the Zama economy haven't really been addressed, namely the abundance of these shafts, huge unemployment, the widest inequality in the world, and a receptive gold market, because all of this gold that gets mined in these inhumane, unimaginably dark conditions makes its way onto the legal gold market. Periodically, as we're seeing now, there'll be a sort of a spasm of trying to do something about it. What's happened in the past is that Zama-Zama activity has just been pushed elsewhere. And I suspect that's what's going to happen this time, but who knows how it's going to shake out.
South African journalist there, Kimon de Greef. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Here now is a reminder, rather, of our top story this hour. What is reported to be the final round of talks on a deal to release hostages and secure a ceasefire in Gaza is taking place in Qatar. Earlier, our correspondent Tom Bateman gave us some of the detail.
A first phase ceasefire deal in which 34 hostages would be released by Hamas in exchange for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. And then crucially, during that six-week process, if it continues to go to plan, the two sides would negotiate phase two.
Other headlines, Ukraine says it's carried out its biggest strikes yet against military targets deep inside Russia. And South African officials have defended their decision to deny food and water to illegal miners who are trapped underground as an operation to rescue hundreds of them continues. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour live from the BBC. Russia is using Ukrainian prisoners of war it holds in captivity as leverage to force their families back in Ukraine to carry out sabotage. The BBC's seen evidence that Russia's using bribery and threats against POWs to persuade worried relatives to carry out spying and sabotage in Ukraine to undermine the war effort. Ukrainian officials say that around half of all POW families are approached by Russian agents. Will Vernon sent this report.
Under arrest, arsonists. Another plot foiled, say Ukraine's security services. Saboteurs recruited by Russia to set fire to military vehicles and railway lines. Many do it for money, paid by suspected Russian agents. But others are motivated by the desperation of waiting for loved ones in captivity.
A Ukrainian number called me. I picked up and he introduced himself as Dmitry.
Svetlana hadn't heard from her husband, Dima, for more than 2 years when she received a strange phone call.
He spoke with a Russian accent. He said, if you want your husband to come home sooner, I can help.
Dima, an army medic, had been captured not long after the full-scale invasion. The man on the phone, Dmitry, said he could arrange for Svetlana to speak to her husband or even organize an early release for him. But there was a price.
He said, I must either set fire to a military facility, a car, or a railway electrical box. The other option was to reveal the location of air defense systems nearby.
Svetlana reported the call to the security service, who told her she should try and buy for time while they investigated. So she played along, pretending to agree to torch a nearby railway facility. She managed to record some of the calls.
Pour in a litre of the fluid and add a bit of petrol. Go to some sort of railway junction. Make sure there are no security cameras and wear a hat, just in case.
The security service then told Svetlana the calls were coming from inside Russia and she should refuse to cooperate further.
And then the threats began. He said they'd kill my husband. For days, he kept calling, saying, your husband is being tortured and it's your fault.
Did you at any point consider going through with it?
No, not for a second. My husband never would have forgiven me if I had done something like that.
In a statement to the BBC, the Security Service of Ukraine said it has thwarted numerous attempts by Russian intelligence to recruit relatives of Ukrainian prisoners of war. They say those who report approaches will be treated as victims, but anyone agreeing to work with Russia can be charged with treason.
How are you?
Petro Yatsenko is from the headquarters for the treatment of prisoners of war, part of Ukrainian military intelligence. They issue advice to families on what to do when approached.
They're in a very vulnerable position, and some of them are ready to do anything, but of course we are working to educate them. In general, it's very minor damage for Ukrainian armed forces, but it can destabilize the Ukrainian society's unity. So it's a main problem.
In a statement, the Russian authorities denied allegations that prisoners' families are used by Russia as leverage and accused Ukraine of coercing people to commit sabotage in Russian territory.
Will Vernon reporting. Finally on the programme today, the global coffee chain Starbucks used to boast that anyone was welcome to sit in its stores, in North America at least, even if they didn't buy anything. Not anymore. Starbucks says it is rolling out a new code of conduct. Heather Haddon is the restaurants reporter at the Wall Street Journal who first reported on this story.
The new CEO, Brian Nickel, since he joined the company last year, has said that he needs to work on the environment of Starbucks stores. He says they need to be inviting, have that coffee shop, you know, cafe environment again. And so he's doing little things to enhance that, like bringing back condiment bars so people can doctor their own coffee with milk, and Sharpies for people to write on their cups with. But then he's doing bigger things, like tightening up a policy that Starbucks has had since 2018 that allowed anyone to use its cafes and its bathrooms. And so the company says, you know, we care about the public, but we care about our customers and our employees, and we have to make our cafe safe and welcoming environments for them. And they hope this will be a way to enhance that.
Critics will say Starbucks doesn't want the wrong kind of people hanging out in its stores. Is there some truth in that?
I guess stepping back, I think this is a pretty common policy for retailers that you're supposed to buy something to be in the store. And these cafes are for people who are patrons, not necessarily just hanging out with no purpose, I guess. I think critics would say, you know, this is a reversal that Starbucks, after that incident in Philadelphia, where two black men were arrested at one of their cafes, that was a real embarrassment for Starbucks. And this policy was meant to address that. You know, a lot has changed since they passed that we've had the pandemic, we've had a lot of changes in society here in America, and in some ways things have gotten more challenging for a retailer like Starbucks to just allow the public to use the stores as they wish.
Is there a wider social issue in the US that there are fewer third spaces, libraries, heated public spaces available for people who are down on their luck just to hang out?
I think that's absolutely true. You looked at the latest homeless count numbers that were released, and we're at very large numbers of people who are just unhoused. They don't have a place to go. And some of that is, again, just how society has been uprooted since the pandemic. So, yeah, it does seem to be that there needs to be other places for these folks. And Starbucks itself says that they do have community outreach programs, and they do try to direct people who need more resources to services. And, you know, their cafes can't just be drop-in centers, that there needs to be other resources for these folks.
This starts in the US, but what are the chances that the changes will be rolled out globally?
Probably unlikely, because from what I understand, this 2018 policy of access to all was only in North America.
Meanwhile, the world's biggest coffee chain, that's what it is trying to tackle flagging sales at the moment. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So that's also a big mandate for this new CEO, is that they've had several quarters now of drops in sales and drops in traffic and transactions. And clearly he is there to try to reverse that. And that's going to take a lot of work. And this is one part of what he's doing to try to just make people want to go to Starbucks again and hang out and not just order their coffee, flee, or just not go anymore.
Heather Haddon, reporter for The Wall Street Journal in Chicago, rounding off this edition of NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, That calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.